Welcome to the Deep Dive, powered by UDEM Research Active Recovery Series.
Today, we are undertaking a really critical mission for a very specific audience. We're talking about the dedicated athlete who is starting to find that the rules of the game, the rules of training and recovery, they're starting to change, especially once you cross that 40-year threshold.
That's so true. If you're a trained individual, what the research actually calls a master athlete, you know that feeling. The recovery demands just shift profoundly. That 48-hour window, it hits different than it did when you were 25.
It really does. And the problem is, advice is everywhere. And frankly, a lot of it is either way too generalized for a trained person, or it's just plain wrong.
So our goal today is to cut through all of that noise, you know, the expensive gadgets, the conflicting trends you see on Instagram, the old school dogma. We want to find the genuinely effective, evidence-backed recovery protocols that will actually maximize your performance and, just as importantly, your longevity in your sport.
Exactly. We've synthesized the latest meta-analyses, a lot of physiological research, and coaching reports to give you a definitive shortcut, a way to be really well-informed without having to read dozens of studies yourself.
And I think defining our audience right at the start is so critical. We are focusing squarely on you, the individual over 40 who maintains regular structured training. You're fit, you are committed, and you're trying to sustain high performance.
And that demographic faces some, you know, unique physiological realities. Cellular recovery is naturally a bit slower, and that risk of injury, it tends to creep up.
But there's a huge silver lining here, right? Something that I found really encouraging in the research.
Yes, and this is a truly crucial finding. Because of your sustained regular activity, you, the master athlete, retain a significantly higher recovery capacity compared to a sedentary older adult.
So it's not just about age.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Physical activity is the primary determinant of your recovery capacity, not your chronological age alone. That's a huge point.
That is incredibly reassuring. So it means we aren't fighting some losing battle against time. We're really just looking for smart, strategic adaptations to what is already an excellent foundation.
Precisely. The central question guiding this entire deep dive is this: what specific evidence-based adjustments, if any, must the fit 40-year-old make to sustain that high performance?
And we've dug into some really top-tier research from places like Frontiers in Nutrition, Sports Medicine, and we've looked at elite coaching frameworks to find the answers.
We have. And this is where it gets, I think, really interesting.
Yeah, we're going to explore some really counterintuitive findings. We'll show you why cheap, almost boring habits often deliver a way higher return on investment than the expensive high-tech gadgets.
And we'll also look at why focusing on a highly technical measurement like, say, lactate clearance isn't the whole story when it comes to maximizing your long-term gains.
Okay, this is going to be good. Let's unpack all of this and start at the very beginning. So let's start with the absolute non-negotiables, the two most cost-effective, high-return interventions. If you only have the time or the budget for two things, where does the research demand we focus?
Every single source we looked at, and I mean every single one, pointed to the same two foundational pillars. It's sleep and nutrition.
No surprise there, but I have a feeling the details matter, especially for this audience.
The details are everything. The return on investment, or ROI, for sleep optimization is immense, especially for the master athlete. You might think, okay, I know I need to sleep, but the mechanism of why sleep is so critical, it actually changes slightly as we age.
And that makes optimizing it even more important.
It does.
So why is sleep so utterly foundational? What is the body actually doing when we're asleep that drives all this recovery?
Well, sleep is when the body initiates and executes its major recovery protocols. This goes far beyond just resting your muscles. It's a comprehensive regulation of your central nervous system, which dictates your readiness for the next day's training.
And crucially, the hormone release, right?
Crucially, the release of growth hormone.
Which is the key to muscle repair and adaptation, correct?
Absolutely. The largest pulses of your body's growth hormone happens specifically during slow-wave sleep. You might know it as deep sleep. This is the body's prime time for anabolic signaling.
So that's when you're repairing damage, building new proteins,
and even solidifying memory and motor skills from your training session. It's a full system reboot.
And there's hard evidence for this, right? I remember reading about some studies that directly linked more sleep to better performance.
There is. You're probably thinking of the work from Stanford researchers with collegiate basketball players. They had athletes extend their nightly sleep to a full 10 hours.
10 hours, wow.
Yeah, and the results were not subtle at all. They improved their sprint times, and their shooting accuracy went up by at least 9%.
9% is a massive gain in elite sports.
It's enormous.
Right.
And they saw similar things with swimmers. Faster reaction times off the blocks, improved turn times, better sprint performance overall, just from prioritizing more hours of quality sleep.
A 9% gain for something that costs nothing but time is, I mean, that's a game changer. So let's zoom in on why the master athlete needs to pay even closer attention to this. Does aging mess with our deep sleep?
It absolutely does. And this is precisely why sleep optimization delivers proportionally larger returns after you turn 40. Aging naturally alters what we call your sleep architecture.
What does that mean, sleep architecture?
It means the structure of your sleep cycles changes. What happens is that older adults experience a reduced amount of that really restorative slow wave or deep sleep. And on top of that, we also see increased sleep fragmentation.
Meaning you're waking up more often during the night.
Exactly. Even if you don't fully remember it in the morning, those little micro awakenings disrupt the whole process.
So if the quality of the raw material, that deep sleep, is already a bit compromised, then maximizing the environment for the sleep we do get becomes the highest priority.
That's the perfect way to frame it. We can't always reverse the change in the architecture itself, but we can absolutely manage the environment. The practical goal remains 7 to 9 hours of quality sleep per night.
And the classic advice, a cool, dark, screen-free room that's all scientifically backed.
It is. But let's dig into the temperature specifically, because the why is fascinating.
Okay, tell us about the mechanism there. Why that specific range of 65 to 68 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 18 to 20 Celsius?
Well, for your body to initiate sleep optimally, your core body temperature has to drop by about 1 to 2 degrees Fahrenheit. It's a physiological trigger.
And a cool room helps that happen.
It facilitates it. This temperature drop supports healthy melatonin function and signals to your brain that it's time to transition into those deep sleep stages. If the room is too warm, your body struggles to shed that heat, and it can actually delay the onset of deep sleep.
So for the master athlete, who already gets less deep sleep to begin with, any barrier to entering that crucial phase is compounded.
Exactly. It makes precise temperature control a really vital, non-negotiable hack for maximizing your body's anabolic signaling overnight.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah. Optimizing a system that's already a little compromised delivers a bigger bang for your buck. Okay, that seamlessly brings us to our second foundational pillar, nutrition, and specifically protein timing. We need to reassess the old beliefs versus the new science on the anabolic window.
Oh, the anabolic window. Let me define that term for anyone who hasn't heard it, you know, preached religiously in a gym locker room for the last 20 years.
We've all been there.
So the anabolic window is that traditional concept suggesting you have to consume protein within this very narrow, like 30 to 45 minute window right after you exercise to maximize muscle gains.
The implication being, if you miss that window, your workout was basically wasted.
That's the myth. And it creates so much anxiety.
I think we've all been that person, you know, hiding a protein shaker in the car, slamming it at a stoplight because we're frantic about missing that magical 30-minute mark. So tell us, what does the new research say about that frantic rush?
The research has substantially revised that concept. It's a huge relief for every busy athlete. The latest findings show that muscle protein synthesis, let's call it MPS.
And let's define that really clearly. MPS is basically the process of your body repairing, growing, and building new muscle tissue.
Perfect definition. That process, MPS, stays elevated for up to 24 hours after you exercise.
24 hours, not 30 minutes.
A full day. A 2024 review from Frontiers in Nutrition shows that MPS actually peaks around 4 to 6 hours post-workout, and then it stays significantly elevated for the rest of that 24-hour period.
Okay, that is a huge strategic shift. The 30-minute time bomb is officially diffused. So what's the critical nutritional takeaway then?
The critical takeaway is that your total daily protein intake and making sure it's evenly distributed across the day matter profoundly more than obsessing over the exact minute you finish your training session.
So that post-workout shake is still a good idea, but it's not magic.
It's still beneficial, for sure. Consuming 20 to 40 grams of protein within a few hours of training is great, but it's not magically superior to the rest of your meals. The focus shifts entirely to the long-term 24-hour supply chain of amino acids to your muscles.
That changes the whole paradigm, from a focus on timing to a focus on total load and distribution. Okay, so let's get specific for the master athlete. We often hear that older adults experience something called anabolic resistance and need more protein. Is that true for a trained 40-year-old?
This is where we have to be careful with generalized advice, because systematic reviews have found that trained master athletes, people who are consistently lifting or training hard, do not face the same degree of anabolic resistance as their sedentary peers.
So because we're training, our muscles are just better at listening when we feed them protein.
That's a great way to put it. Sustained physical activity effectively keeps the muscle machinery responsive. It keeps the communication lines open.
So what does that mean for our daily protein target?
It means that trained master athletes need about 1.4 to 2.1 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight per day to maintain and build muscle mass.
Now, how does that compare to younger athletes?
It's essentially the same range that's recommended for younger athletes.
That is truly fascinating. So the act of sustained training maintains our protein processing efficiency as we age. So how do we optimize the distribution of that protein across the day?
The most practical recommendation from the research is to distribute that total intake across 4 to 5 meals or, you know, feeding opportunities throughout the day.
So no skipping breakfast and then having a huge steak for dinner.
Right. You're aiming for approximately 0.3 grams per kilogram of body weight per meal. This consistently triggers that muscle protein synthesis response. It provides a constant trickle of raw material for repair rather than a flood and then a drought.
Now, is there any specific protein adjustment that does benefit the master athlete more than a younger person? This is where that age difference might really kick in.
Yes, there is one major finding that speaks directly to the reality of the 40-plus body, and that is consuming 40 grams of casein protein right before sleep. This seems to maximize overnight synthesis rates.
And that's a higher dose, right? The typical recommendation for younger people is more like 20 to 25 grams.
It is higher. And there's a good reason for it.
So why casein protein specifically, and why the bigger dose?
Well, casein is a much slower digesting protein than something like whey. It actually forms a gel in your stomach, and it releases amino acids very steadily over several hours.
Ah, so it's like a time-release protein source.
Exactly. And because the master athlete often experiences, as we discussed, reduced deep sleep and a longer overnight fast, providing that larger, sustained supply of amino acids, that 40 grams of casein delivers a persistent signal for muscle building throughout the entire night.
So it's effectively bridging the gap between dinner and breakfast.
Perfectly said. This sustained release appears to be highly advantageous for the 40-plus athlete who really wants to maximize every minute of overnight repair.
Okay, so we've absolutely nailed the two cost-effective foundations, sleep quality and strategic protein distribution. Now let's move to the concept that's central to this deep dive. Active recovery, often called AR. Let's unpack the core mechanism and the debate around it.
Right. So active recovery is defined as low-intensity exercise immediately following some kind of strenuous exertion. It's usually performed at about 40 to 60% of your maximum heart rate.
So we're talking about things like a light spin on a bike, a gentle walk, maybe an easy swim.
Exactly. And its primary, most well-documented mechanism is something called lactate clearance.
Okay, we hear lactate clearance all the time, but a lot of people still wrongly blame lactate for their muscle soreness the next day. What does the research say lactate actually is?
That's a great question, because that old myth about lactate causing soreness is incredibly persistent. Lactate is simply a byproduct of anaerobic energy use.
So it's created during intense high-output exercise.
Right, and it's not waste. That's the key. We now know it's actually a completely usable fuel source. Your body can convert it back into energy.
So how does active recovery, or AR, work to clear it faster than just, you know, sitting down on a bench?
The mechanism is all about blood flow. Light movement maintains an elevated blood flow throughout your body, much higher than if you were just sitting still.
And that circulation is key.
It's everything. This increased circulation allows tissues with high oxidative capacity. We're talking mainly about your large leg muscles, your liver, and even your heart, to act as lactate sinks.
Lactate sinks, I like that.
They effectively pull the lactate out of the bloodstream and convert it back to usable glucose or energy. Sitting still just dramatically reduces this necessary flow, meaning the lactate just kind of lingers in the system for longer.
And we have concrete evidence showing this acute benefit, right? I remember seeing a study on climbers.
Yes, a study published in the Journal of Sports Sciences looked at sport climbers. They had them alternate between short bouts of active recovery, just walking, and passive rest between their intense climbing trials.
And the results were clear?
Unambiguous. The active recovery resulted in 0.9 to 1.2 millimoles per liter, lower mean lactate concentrations compared to just sitting down between efforts.
So let's translate that number. What does a reduction of, say, 1 mmol/L of lactate actually mean for you in the middle of a workout?
It means your tissues are less saturated with those metabolic byproducts, so they can rely less on those anaerobic pathways in the next effort. Essentially, your next set or your next sprint starts from a physiologically cleaner baseline.
Which should delay local muscle fatigue.
It does. And it allows for higher performance repeatability within that single session.
And the protocol in that study was surprisingly short, wasn't it?
Very short and very targeted. It was just a 2-minute walking-based active recovery. And then that was followed by about 1.5 minutes of passive refocusing.
So just 3.5 minutes between efforts, and that was enough to make a difference.
It was enough to successfully maintain their performance levels by enhancing that clearance.
And beyond the physiological markers, active recovery also has psychological benefits, right? This is where perceived exertion, or RPE, comes in.
Yes, and this is a big one. So RPE is just your subjective feeling of effort, usually scored on a simple 1 to 10 scale.
And what did the research find about how active recovery affects that subjective feeling?
Participants reported RPE scores that were consistently 0.6 to 1.0 points higher when they used passive rest compared to when they did active recovery.
So not only does AR clean up the fuel supply faster, but it also makes you feel less tired.
Less tired, less taxed, and more ready for that next interval or the next set. It's a powerful combination.
Okay, so now we arrive at the paradox. And this is a really critical strategic lesson. We have these clear acute benefits, faster lactate clearance, lower RPE. But does all of this translate to better long-term fitness adaptation?
This is the crucial contradiction. And it often challenges that common gym wisdom that, you know, every minute you spend on recovery just compounds into superior fitness over time.
So while AR is fantastic for improving performance within a single session.
Right. The question is, does it matter over months? And a systematic review published in Sports Medicine Open in 2024 looked at exactly that. It examined whether the recovery type active versus passive affected long-term adaptations during interval training programs.
And what did this big comprehensive review conclude?
The finding was pretty stark. When applied over weeks and months of training, the type of recovery you do, whether it's active or passive, does not appear to affect training-induced outcomes.
Wow, that's a huge finding. So let me be really clear on this. If I train hard for 6 weeks and I just sit down and rest between my intervals, and you train just as hard, but you religiously do 5 minutes of active recovery on a bike.
Yes.
The end result, our fitness gain, our VO2 max increase, our strength adaptation will likely be the same.
That is the implication of the review's synthesis of all the available data. The long-term physiological adaptations, it seems, are driven by the intensity and the volume of the training stress itself, not by how quickly you clear lactate immediately afterwards.
But wait a second. If active recovery makes me feel 1 point better on that RPE scale, isn't that psychological advantage worth it? Isn't that little lift crucial for making sure I can actually hit my target intensity on those last few intervals?
It absolutely is. And that's why AR remains a really valuable tool. It's critical for maximizing your performance on those high-quality training days.
So if it allows you to perform your final interval at the prescribed intensity instead of fading out because you feel so tired,
then it has served its purpose perfectly. But the strategic lesson here is that AR is a highly effective session optimization tool, not a long-term fitness multiplier.
So the takeaway is, use active recovery to perform better during the workout, but don't feel guilty or worry about long-term consequences if you occasionally have to skip a cool-down walk because you're short on time.
Exactly. This knowledge allows the busy 40-year-old athlete to manage their training stress pragmatically and without any false expectations about what it's doing for them.
So in the first section, we established that a fit 40-year-old has surprisingly similar protein needs to a younger athlete, all thanks to consistent training. But now we have to address the elephant in the room. What does fundamentally change for a trained athlete over 40 that directly impacts our need for recovery?
Let's ground ourselves again in the positive first. What doesn't change is the reassuring finding that master athletes, through that sustained training, maintain their capillary networks, they maintain healthy inflammatory profiles, and they have a significant muscle adaptation capacity that's comparable to younger athletes.
So consistency is preserving our youthful capacity.
It really is. But we have to confront what does change, and that is the speed of recovery, specifically from high-force eccentric exercise.
Okay, let's define that. Eccentric exercise is when the muscle is actively lengthening under tension. So things like the lowering phase of a heavy squat or the impact of running.
Exactly. Aggressive downhill running is a classic example that just wrecks people's quads.
So why is eccentric exercise the specific trigger for this delayed recovery after 40?
Well, those eccentric contractions cause a lot of microtrauma to the muscle fibers. It's a normal part of training. Now, in a younger athlete, the body's repair crew, which includes inflammatory cells and these specialized stem cells called satellite cells, they arrive really quickly, clean up the damage, and initiate new protein synthesis very swiftly.
And in older muscle tissue.
In aged muscle tissue, research shows a pattern of, and I'm quoting here, delayed, prolonged, and inefficient recovery.
That sounds not great.
It means the whole process is slowed down. Specifically, the immune response, which is characterized by those extended inflammatory signals, just takes longer to resolve. And the activation of those crucial satellite cells, the ones that fuse to repair and build new muscle, is slower.
So if a younger athlete might recover and regenerate in 48 hours.
The 40-plus athlete's peak repair processes might take 72 or even 96 hours to fully conclude.
So the body still repairs itself, but the entire process is just operating on a slower clock. And if those peak repair processes take longer, then a traditional rest day might not be enough to absorb an intense training load before the next session starts.
Exactly. You end up stacking new training stress on top of existing unresolved fatigue. And this is where coaches and researchers emphasize the absolute need for structured transition phases following periods of intense training.
Whether it's the end of a long season or just a brutal training block.
Right. You have to mandate a longer reset.
So what does that structured transition look like, and why is the duration longer than it would be for a 25-year-old?
The recommended protocol duration is 2 to 4 weeks total. It's longer because we have to account for both that tissue repair deficit and the accumulated nervous system fatigue. You know, cortisol levels, things like that. It's divided into two critical phases.
Okay, what's phase one?
Phase one, full rest day. This is non-negotiable, and it lasts for 7 to 10 days of complete cessation of any structured training.
7 to 10 days of total rest feels really mentally challenging for a trained athlete. Why is that duration so crucial?
It's necessary to fully pull the nervous system out of that state of chronic fatigue. The 7-10 days ensures the body has moved past the acute inflammatory phase, which, as we just discussed, is prolonged in the master athlete, and allows those central nervous system markers to normalize.
So the focus isn't on fitness at all?
No. The focus here is entirely on foundational recovery, maximizing sleep, ensuring you're hydrated, and engaging in light, untracked, non-taxing movement. Gentle yoga, walking the dog. The goal is sensory deprivation from the stress of structured, tracked effort.
And then you move into phase two.
Then you move into phase two, active recovery. This lasts for weeks 2 through 3, or maybe even 4. You consciously reintroduce short, easy aerobic sessions, maybe 20 to 40 minutes long, and a couple of light strength or mobility sessions per week.
And the critical factor here has to be intensity management.
It is paramount. The intensity must be strictly limited to an RPE of 2 to 3. So if RPE 1 is sitting on the couch and RPE 10 is an all-out sprint.
RPE 2 to 3 is true conversational intensity.
It is. You should be able to hold a full, easy, continuous conversation, even tell a knock-knock joke, without running out of breath.
I love that definition. That low intensity ensures we're promoting circulation and nutrient delivery, which helps the muscles continue to repair, but without imposing any new systemic strain.
That's the perfect balance. This strategic low-intensity reintroduction prevents you from suffering that significant detraining penalty of total inactivity while still being profoundly restorative.
So the practical implication for the 40-year-old athlete who's training intensely is that we need to be much more deliberate about these mandated longer rest periods. We just can't skip the annual or biannual reset.
Precisely. The general coaching consensus is to integrate a full transition phase like this after every 8 to 12 weeks of intense effort. And even week to week, the master's athlete should probably consider adding an extra recovery day every 2 to 4 weeks compared to protocols designed for a younger cohort.
And skipping this structured transition just risks injury, burnout, and incomplete healing.
It's a recipe for disaster in the long run.
Okay, we've established that strategic rest framework. Now let's transition into the fun part, the world of high-tech recovery. When we look at professional sports, it seems like money is no object. Recovery has become this multi-billion dollar arms race.
It absolutely has. Top professional teams are investing staggering amounts of money because they are operating at the absolute margin of human performance. And we look at these case studies not to emulate them, but to understand what marginal gains look like when money is truly unlimited.
Right. So it helps us benchmark the value of the incremental benefits we might get from our much cheaper, high ROI options.
Exactly.
So give us some insight into that professional investment. What are they spending on the absolute cutting edge?
Well, the examples really illustrate the obsession with incremental advantage. The NFL's New Orleans Saints, for example, dedicated over a third of their training room to high-tech recovery. They installed a cryo chamber, a float tank, pneumatic compression boots, massage guns, the works.
And what about the LA Rams? I heard they had something even more advanced.
They deployed a highly specialized $160,000 multi-therapy chamber. It's known as the Immortal Chamber, designed for deep tissue recovery.
A six-figure machine for just one piece of equipment, that is just staggering.
And it's not just the teams. The athletes themselves often fund their own routines to augment this.
Mm-hmm.
You look at an elite masters athlete like LeBron James, who is 39 years old, and he reportedly spends millions annually on his own layered routine of cryotherapy, hyperbaric oxygen, and Normatec compression just to maintain his body.
These cases provide context, but for the average master athlete, we need a really rigorous cost-benefit analysis. So let's contrast this spending with the price of these services on the 2025 U.S. market, which can add up really quickly.
The contrast is essential for perspective. If you want to access these modalities yourself, the cost of routine maintenance is substantial. A single whole-body cryotherapy session can run you $50 to $100.
A 60-minute professional massage.
You're looking at $60 to $150, easily. Compression boot therapy, like the Normatec style, often costs $30 to $40 for just 30 minutes. Even a sauna drop-in at a local gym or spa is often $30 to $50 for a half hour.
So if you train 5 days a week and decide you want to routinely add cryotherapy, you could spend $2,500 a month just on recovery treatments. We need to know if the science actually justifies that kind of spending. Let's look at hydrotherapy and compression.
And here we found a massive challenge to conventional wisdom. The research shows that cold water immersion, the classic ice bath, exhibits no clear advantage over light active recovery for reducing inflammation.
Wait, say that again.
You heard it correctly. A quick 10-minute walk after your workout, which costs nothing, is comparable to a cold plunge in terms of acute inflammation reduction.
That truly challenges a massive assumption in sports culture. So if your goal is just reducing inflammation, save the $50 and take a walk. Okay, what about the modalities that do show a measurable benefit, like compression and cryo? Let's quantify the gains.
We quantify them using a statistical measure called a Fagenzeis, which is a standardized way to measure the magnitude of a finding. So, for example, compression stockings improve strength and jump performance at 24 hours, with effect sizes around 6.38 to 0.62.
And cold water immersion.
That showed effect sizes ranging from 0.33 to 1.01 for sprint performance recovery.
So translate those numbers for us. What does an effect size of, say, 0.62 actually mean in practical terms for me?
It means these modalities provide a small to medium but measurable physical benefit. They typically lead to a 2 to 10% improvement in specific metrics, like your jump height recovery or your sprint repeatability or just reduced muscle soreness at about 8 to 24 hours post-exercise.
So the benefit is real, but it is incremental. You're paying $50 or $100 for a single-digit percentage improvement.
Exactly. So if you're training for general fitness, that 5% sprint recovery boost is probably irrelevant. But if you're a competitive 10K runner trying to shave 2 seconds off your repeat time, it might be worth it.
But only if your foundational recovery, the sleep and protein we talked about, is already perfected.
Absolutely. You should reserve these expensive modalities for strategic use or when those marginal gains truly matter. For routine maintenance, the research pushes us hard toward the cost-effective toolkit, the gear that gives you the highest ROI per dollar.
Okay, so what are the budget heroes here? The things that give us 80% of the benefit for 10% of the cost?
The simple devices completely dominate this high ROI category. For foam rolling, the sources all agree that a basic Amazon Basics high-density roller, which costs around $20 to $25, performs comparably to much pricier options.
And if you want to step up a little,
mid-tier options, like the TriggerPoint GRID, which is around $40 to $50, offer proven durability and pressure distribution without a huge investment.
What about percussion massage guns?
For massage guns, the budget leaders include things like the Ekron Bantam, priced around $60, or maybe the Theragun Mini at $199. These offer basic percussion relief, which can materially aid recovery by improving localized blood flow.
And you compare that to the gold standard Normatec boots,
which cost $799 to $999. It's a massive jump in price for what is, again, an incremental, albeit very convenient gain. And for compression gear, High-quality graduated compression socks, like from CEP or 2XU, cost about $50 to $60 a pair and are highly reviewed and very effective.
The strategic lesson is so clear. Leverage the cost-effective tech for your routine day-to-day maintenance and reserve the really expensive stuff for strategic acute use, not for general recovery.
That's the smart way to play it.
We've covered cold therapy. Now let's turn to heat. Sauna protocols have been getting a lot of fresh research attention. So what does the evidence say about heat therapy's role in recovery, and how does it compare to cold?
Heat therapy is strongly evidence-backed for recovery, but it works through a completely different mechanism than cold. It promotes recovery through things like heat shock proteins and improved circulation, whereas cold mainly targets acute pain and inflammation modulation.
Okay, let's quickly define the two main types of sauna that we see most often.
First, you have the traditional or Finnish sauna. This uses heated rocks to heat the air to a very high temperature, typically 80 to 90 degrees Celsius. This raises your core body temperature very quickly and elevates your heart rate,
providing a light cardiovascular stress.
It does. And then you have the infrared or IR sauna. This uses panels at much lower air temperatures, around 40 to 60 Celsius, to emit light that heats your tissue more directly.
Do they both deliver tangible recovery benefits?
Yes. Meta-analyses confirm that both types reduce post-exercise soreness and boost your overall perceived recovery compared to just passive rest. Specifically, one study found that a single 20-minute infrared sauna session attenuated the drop in explosive performance and significantly reduced muscle soreness after a heavy bout of resistance exercise.
So how should we be integrating this? What's the optimal frequency and timing?
The general protocol is about 15 to 20 minutes per session, performed 2 to 3 times weekly for consistent benefits. But timing is critical for recovery. Experts advise waiting 15 to 30 minutes after you train to cool down and rehydrate before you get in the sauna.
Why is that waiting period so important?
If you jump in immediately after a really hard session, you risk prolonging the period that your core temperature is elevated, and you're actually adding strain to your system rather than helping it recover.
Now, you mentioned a critical caveat for the master athlete related to stress load. We need to dig into this before anyone just jumps right in.
This is a major practical finding. Heat therapy functions as what we call a hormetic stressor. It benefits the system by stressing it just a little bit, which forces a positive adaptation.
A bit like exercise itself.
Exactly. However, the research found that the initial infrared sauna sessions caused an acute physiological stress response. They specifically measured an increased nocturnal heart rate and elevated cortisol levels after the first few sessions.
So initially, it makes me less recovered.
Temporarily, yes. Those stress markers, the elevated cortisol and that increased heart rate during sleep, which signal nervous system fatigue, they only diminished and normalized after approximately 6 weeks of regular exposure.
That's a long adaptation period.
It is. And it means the master athlete, who may already be battling high chronic stress from work, family, and training, has to integrate sauna use very gradually. If you dive into daily sauna sessions from day one, you might just compound your existing nervous system fatigue for the first month and a half before the true benefits of adaptation kick in.
So you have to adapt to the heat, just like you adapt to lifting weights. That's fantastic targeted guidance. Okay, let's move quickly to contrast therapy, alternating hot and cold. We've called this the vascular dance.
Contrast therapy is a consistent winner for alleviating soreness and swelling. The vascular dance refers to the alternating rapid vasoconstriction from the cold and vasodilation from the heat.
So the blood vessels are squeezing and then opening up.
Right. This pumping action effectively modulates the inflammatory phase, it flushes out metabolic byproducts, and it improves blood flow to the recovery site. Participants consistently report a 20 to 30% reduction in perceived pain.
And the cost-conscious home solution here gives us the same physiological benefit for literally $0.
That's right. The home solution is contrast showers.
Yeah.
Just alternate 1 to 3 minutes of cold water with warm water and repeat that for 3 to 5 cycles. It provides the exact same powerful physiological stimulus for no cost.
Okay, finally in this section, let's get into personalized tracking with wearables and heart rate variability, or HRV. This is where the busy master athlete can become their own objective scientist, tracking their body's response to all these different modalities.
Let me first define HRV. Heart rate variability measures the minute fluctuation in time between your successive heartbeats. It's not your heart rate itself, but the variation in that rate.
And it's a proxy for our nervous system state, right?
It's a direct proxy for the balance in your autonomic nervous system. It reflects the ratio between your sympathetic or fight or flight system and your parasympathetic or rest and digest system. High variability typically indicates a relaxed, well-recovered state.
But the accuracy of all these consumer devices is hugely variable. If we're going to make training decisions based on this data, accuracy is paramount. So which devices can we actually trust for precise HRV monitoring?
The dedicated recovery-focused devices really lead the field here when they're validated against the medical gold standard, which is a chest strap monitor. Specifically, the Whoop and the Aura Ring are considered highly accurate, with Aura often showing the smallest error margin.
And they measure during sleep, which is key.
Yes, when you are most still and your body is in a stable state.
And what about the very popular smartwatches that people use every day, like an Apple Watch or a Garmin?
They are fantastic for tracking your training load, but they are less reliable for precise HRV. Wristwatches often use PPG sensors that, while convenient, can significantly underestimate your true HRV. One study found that the Apple Watch HRV errors were around 29% compared to the chest strap reference.
A 29% error is massive. Translate that into a practical consequence for my training.
A 29% error in your HRV reading means the watch might tell you you're green and ready to crush a heavy session, when in reality, your nervous system is deeply fatigued, stressed, and still recovering.
And that kind of misleading data leads directly to overtraining.
Overtraining, injury, or burnout. Absolutely. So the firm recommendation for the master athlete who is serious about recovery monitoring is to use a dedicated recovery device like an Aura or a Whoop for precise HRV monitoring, and then supplement that data with their sport watch for their training load and intensity tracking.
And what's the simple rule for applying this data in real time? How do I use it?
A simple, actionable rule of thumb is this: a 10 to 15% drop in your daily HRV reading below your established individual baseline signals incomplete recovery.
So it's a clear objective warning sign.
It is. It warrants an adjustment. You either reduce your training stress, shorten an intense session, or maybe just take a full rest day. Monitoring your HRV directly addresses that specific challenge of detecting accumulated fatigue before it manifests as a physical injury.
We've covered everything from cellular repair to $160,000 hyperchambers. Now let's bring it all together into some practical, time-efficient protocols for the busy 40-year-old athlete who's training 10 or more hours a week.
The key is compression and integration into your existing routines. We can call them mini protocols. For example, immediately post-workout, target about 15 to 20 minutes total.
So what does that look like?
You do 5 to 10 minutes of an active cool down, a walk, or some gentle activity. That's immediately followed by consuming your protein and carbs, and then 5 to 10 minutes of dedicated foam rolling on your tightest muscle groups.
So that's high impact recovery compressed into just 20 minutes. A very high ROI.
A very high ROI.
But beyond that immediate post-workout window, how can we leverage the rest of the day for recovery when so many of us spend hours sitting at a desk?
We have to intentionally counteract the negative effects of that prolonged sedentary behavior. It causes local circulation stagnation and stiffness. So we recommend borrowing a concept from strength training called greasing the groove.
I like that name. What does it mean?
It means performing 5 minutes of low-intensity movement, light stretching, or some gentle mobility every 2 hours throughout your workday.
So you're microdosing activity.
Exactly. This constant microdosing of activity accumulates a substantial amount of recovery-supporting movement, and it prevents that tissue stagnation from setting in.
And finally, let's discuss the truly underappreciated strategy for recovery, which is related to lifestyle and time management: cognitive load management.
This is arguably the highest leverage lifestyle intervention, especially for the 40-plus demographic that's often juggling work, family, and training stress. We know that high chronic psychological stress chronically elevates cortisol.
And cortisol is a catabolic hormone. It breaks things down.
It does. It actively interferes with muscle repair and anabolic signaling.
So the stress of a high-pressure job or complex family logistics is physically inhibiting my ability to repair muscle for my workout.
Precisely. Chronic stress raises your baseline level of cortisol and essentially creates this constant headwind that your recovery systems have to fight against.
What's the solution?
Strategic outsourcing. Outsourcing time-consuming, low-value chores, things like house cleaning or lawn care, effectively reduces that baseline psychological and cognitive load. By lowering the administrative burden of your life, you translate that reduced psychological stress directly into lower chronic cortisol levels and improved physiological recovery capacity.
So time management in this context becomes a covert, high-leverage physiological recovery tool. That's a powerful idea. Now, if the master athlete isn't hitting their recovery goals despite optimizing all the protocols we've discussed, what are the most common pitfalls? What are the practitioner warnings?
Practitioners who specialize in masters athletes consistently warn against five core recovery mistakes, often because they get dismissed as just, you know, lifestyle issues.
What's number one?
Number one is ignoring stress management. Chronically elevated cortisol will negate every benefit from your advanced training and all the fancy modalities. It interferes directly with muscle repair.
Number two has to be sleep.
It is. Inconsistent or poor quality sleep. This compromises anabolic signaling, as we discussed. It's the most common factor leading to stalled progress. If you're not getting 7 to 9 hours, almost nothing else matters.
Number three.
A sedentary lifestyle outside the gym. Sitting for hours after you train causes that circulation stagnation, it exacerbates stiffness, and it reduces the effectiveness of nutrient delivery to your muscles. Grease the groove.
Okay, four and five.
Four is insufficient fueling, particularly with protein. Recovery requires raw materials. Hard training combined with low protein intake prevents adequate muscle protein synthesis. And number five is simply underhydration. Even minor dehydration inhibits muscle repair and compromises nutrient transport.
This brings us to what might be the biggest insight from all the sources, which really reinforces the need for that personalized tracking we talked about. Individual variability, or the N of one experiment.
This is the definitive conclusion from a comprehensive umbrella review that looked at 22 studies and over 1,100 endurance athletes. And the review explicitly concluded, and I'm quoting again, "There is no particular recovery strategy that can be advised to enhance recovery between training sessions."
Wow. So no single magic bullet for everyone.
None. And the reason is extremely high individual variability.
So that means the millions that LeBron James spends on cryotherapy might not work for our listener, even if they had the budget, because their physiological response is completely unique.
Correct. We are all N of one experiments. What works for your training partner or what's trendy on social media might produce minimal or even negative benefits for you.
So the practical implication is that you have to track your own responses rigorously using the tools we discussed. HRV, sleep quality, training logs over a period of 4 to 8 weeks.
You have to. Does contrast therapy reduce your soreness more than foam rolling does? Does that 40 grams of casein before sleep actually move your HRV needle? Personalized objective experimentation matters more than anything else.
Okay, let's provide our final summary. The three core principles we really want you to walk away with from this deep dive.
Let's consolidate our findings into three core principles for the master athlete.
One, prioritize the foundation. Sleep, targeting 8 to 9 hours, and adequate distributed protein, aiming for that 1.4 to 2.0 grams per kilogram per day, including that 40 grams of casein pre-sleep, provide the highest, most cost-effective return on your investment. Nail these first.
Two, be pragmatic with tech. Reserve the expensive modalities like routine cryotherapy or high-end pneumatic boots for strategic use when those marginal gains are truly critical. For your day-to-day, routinely leverage cost-effective, evidence-backed tools, the $20 foam roller, contrast showers, and maybe occasional sauna sessions. Understanding their benefits are modest but cheap.
And three, adjust for age, don't overhaul. The fit 40-year-old maintains a similar capacity to younger athletes, but you must incorporate longer, structured transition phases, that 2 to 4 week reset after intense blocks. And you have to monitor personalized metrics like HRV closely for signs of that accumulated nervous system fatigue.
Before we close, it's also important to acknowledge the research gaps. We still need more long-term, longitudinal studies on master athlete recovery specifically. We need more head-to-head comparisons of these modalities conducted directly in the 40-plus population.
And verification of that extended 24-hour muscle protein synthesis window.
Yes, across more diverse cohorts.
But the research we have provides a really clear, actionable roadmap for today. And that leaves us with a provocative thought for you to consider as you adapt your own recovery protocols. If physical activity determines recovery capacity more than chronological age, the biggest recovery investment you can make isn't in a new machine, but in ensuring that your commitment to consistent, sustainable training is maintained year after year.
Sustained activity is the ultimate recovery strategy.
That's the deep dive. Find full research and sources at research.yuda.me. That's Y-U-D-A.me.